From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The number of cases of cyclosporiasis continues to rise, causing explosive diarrhea. More than 500 cases have been reported in our state, and we look at how you might avoid it. We'll also get an update on HIV. Despite advances in treatment and prevention, HIV continues to disproportionately affect Black residents of Mecklenburg County. Modern medicine allows those living with HIV to lead long, healthy, productive lives, and prevention tools like PrEP dramatically reduce transmission. Yet persistent disparities remain, with Black residents accounting for 60% of new cases. Why that gap continues to exist, this hour on Charlotte Talks. First, the news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Contracting HIV used to be a death sentence. That is no longer the case. Thanks to medications, those with HIV can lead long, healthy, productive lives. But despite that, or perhaps because of it, HIV continues to spread, particularly in the African-American community. And that is true nationwide and here in Mecklenburg County. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to look at why that is the case, the stigmas and mistrust surrounding it, and the barriers to access to care and treatment. But first, cyclosporiasis, and I hope I said that right. Like so many illnesses, this is one that most of us have never heard about until very recently. It began to appear in the Midwest and the Northeast and has now reached North Carolina. Health officials have traced it to produce, specifically lettuce, and even more specifically, to one farm in Mexico. Now that we have a significant number of cases here, we're going to spend some time talking about what this is, how it affects you, how it's treated, and more. Dr. Megan Easterday is the medical director at Cabarrus Health Alliance, and she joins us now for the first part of the program. Thank you for being here. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let me start with a basic question. What is cyclospora, the organism that is causing this outbreak? What is it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's actually an intestinal parasite. We don't hear a lot about parasite infections in the United States. It was mostly about viruses and bacterial infections. But it causes a lot of common symptoms that we think about as being a stomach bug. But the treatment looks a little different.
How common is this? I mean, have we had outbreaks of this in the past? Why is this getting so much attention if we have?
Yeah, so, you know, it's not a new infection. It's an infection that's actually been reportable for many, many years, both locally in our state as well as nationally. But typically, a bad year, we would see about 1,000 cases. And the up prior to this most recent outbreak, in 2023, the highest number was around 1,500, and that was considered a huge outbreak. This particular outbreak, we're already at 4,000 confirmed cases. And there's about 7,000 cases that haven't been confirmed yet. So we are way higher than what we've seen in the past.
Are we having more of these outbreaks, either parasitic or bacterial or viral, in recent years than we used to have? Or are we just more plugged in terms of our information cycle about these things? Because it seems like they're happening every other week.
It does. It does feel that way. And, you know, I think that big of a jump, and particularly an infection like this, there probably really, really are more cases. And why that is, I don't have a great explanation for. You know, I think there are certain infections, particularly respiratory viruses, that we're seeing more of because I think we're doing more testing. I think we have much more sophisticated tests available. But I think this is actually an increase.
If you're having breakfast while you're listening, put your cereal spoon down, because the symptoms here are not pleasant to talk about while you're eating, but it often results in watery, often explosive diarrhea, loss of appetite, weight loss, stomach cramps, bloating, increased gas, nausea, and fatigue, all unpleasant symptoms to say the least. But how dangerous is this? Can it be fatal?
It can be. Most people who have a, a normal immune system are going to be able to handle the cyclosporine infection, may need antibiotics to treat it, but may not. The problem is it lasts for much longer than your typical infection. And if you're not able to keep up with the volume intake that you need, it can cause you to become severely dehydrated. It can cause a decrease in your kidney function. It can cause electrolyte abnormalities and things like that, and cause hospitalizations. And, in North Carolina, we've already had 13 hospitalizations related to this. So definitely something that can be more serious than your regular stomach virus.
You threw out some numbers a second ago. Let me throw out some more. As of yesterday, the CDC said there were 4,173 cases in 34 states that had been lab confirmed. Nearly 7,500 other cases have been reported but are unconfirmed. North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services has not published an official number. I don't know why, but news reports indicate that there have been 500 cases so far in North Carolina, and at last report, 29 of those cases were in Mecklenburg County. You're joining us from Cabarrus County. Only one case has been reported there, to the best of my knowledge. You can correct me in a moment. Most of the nation's cases have been in the Midwest, although it is spreading. And we've heard conflicting reports on where this outbreak originated, but it appears to be associated with lettuce from one company, Taylor Farms, and their outfit in someplace in Mexico. How certain are public health officials about that?
So, I think they're pretty certain. I mean, that's definitely a higher level than me doing that level of investigation. I think they're pretty certain about that definitely being a source. But I think this many cases, there's definitely concerns that it may not be the only source. Or at this point, there may be other foods and other things that we need to be concerned about. It does seem like they're pretty confident through their investigations and through the information that they have that that was definitely a large initial a large source to start this all off.
And although there may be other sources other than lettuce, they've pointed particularly to iceberg lettuce. Does that mean that all of us should avoid iceberg lettuce? And I ask because I read an article this morning that said the produce departments around the country are sitting their stock full of produce and nobody's touching it.
I tend to try to not overreact on these types of situations, but the problem with this particular type of virus is there's such a lag time. And because it's a parasite, sorry, not this particular virus, but because it's a parasite and not a
Right,
virus,
right.
it released spores, and those spores can last for extended periods of time. And with that many cases around, the risk of contamination is so high. And right now, we're not seeing any decrease in the number of cases.
Well, let me ask you this. If there's an infected head of lettuce sitting in the grocery store shelf or on some shelf in a restaurant someplace, and it is infected, can it produce spores that then travel over to other pieces of produce, tomatoes, celery, whatever's in the produce section?
Yes, sir. The spores themselves can actually, can physically fall from that lettuce to anything that's nearby. And that's the thing, the spore is basically just a protective environment for this parasite. So it helps it survive outside of the host. And it makes it difficult to kill with our typical just rinsing or heat, those types of things.
Is consuming whatever infected produce there may be the only way we get it? In other words, if you come down with this parasite, can you spread it to someone else?
Fortunately, that does not typically happen. Typically, you shed the spore, and then because it takes about 2 weeks to become infectious, it's usually going to be only you're only going to get it if you eat food or water or consume water that has the parasite and the spores in it. So you're not going to give it to your loved ones.
Am I correct in saying that this parasite finds its way onto produce because human feces have found its way, their way onto produce? Is that how this is transmitted, or are there other ways?
So typically people spread it and lose it through their stool, but it can also infect water. And oftentimes where it tends to get infected is either the water that's cleaning the produce has the parasite present, or sometimes fertilizers, manure, things like that that are used when growing the produce may have the infection.
Well, speaking of water, one of our listeners, Houston, emails us, is the Mecklenburg County Department of Health testing sewage for the presence of cyclospora? You are in Cabarrus County, so perhaps you cannot answer that question about Mecklenburg, but is that one way that health departments determine the risk?
So we have done wastewater testing, particularly during COVID. They were doing that. I'm not familiar with them doing that for cyclospora, but that's definitely something I could look into and let you know more about.
Okay, we'd appreciate that. Americans have come to trust the food supply, largely because we have federal agencies like the FDA and the CDC. But we know that with DOGE, those agencies were hollowed out to a great degree, and in fact, the portion of one of those agencies that deals with parasitic infections was slow to respond to this because they're low on staff. That we've been told, at least, that is the case. And political sentiment has caused these agencies to take a different approach to a lot of different public health situations. 2 days ago, RFK Jr., the Secretary of Health and Human Services, said the outbreak is under control. Is it?
You know, I think it's hard to know at a national level. I mean, I think that, you know, we're continuing to see increased numbers of these cases. So I would say that I don't think we have it under control yet. I think we know the source. I think we're working on it. But the other thing that I think we have to be careful in these situations is, you know, I learned as a physician during COVID, so we have to be very, very careful about introducing politics into public health, because I think it erodes the trust of everyone. So, you know, I think we've isolated a problem, and, you know, I think it, you know, we now can work on that. But I don't know that we, from my perspective, I can't put blame on anyone necessarily at this point in time.
So given this and other outbreaks of other problems with our food supply that are pathogens in our food supply, how concerned should we be about produce in the grocery store, eating a salad at a restaurant, eating uncooked produce anywhere at home, in restaurants, fast food, etc.?
You know, I think right now there definitely is reason to have some concern. You know, I think I would be cautious when you go out and get a burger instead of getting lettuce and tomato. You probably do want to avoid those things until we start seeing these cases start to drop. I think overall we still do a really good job with our food safety.
You can buy in the grocery store now a prepackaged lettuce, and there are probably other products as well, that say on the container, triply washed, ready to eat. Can we trust that, or should we wash it again?
I would wash it again. And I'm guilty of not doing that myself, but especially right now, I would be sure that is probably one of the highest risk items right now is going to be the ones that are pre-washed.
So how do we wash it? How do we get whatever's on it off? How should we handle the produce? How should we handle ourselves once we've washed that produce? What about our hands?
Yeah. You know, so definitely friction is the best thing as far as the water goes. There's no evidence that using any type of products or things like that helps. So vinegar, bleach, all of these soaps, things that you hear, there's no evidence to show that improves. It's really just friction. So, you know, really trying to aggressively wash and rinse as much as possible is best. And if it's something that you can heat, if you can get it to 158 degrees, that will kill the infection.
So when you say friction, is it just the friction of the water going over the produce, or is it your hands rubbing the produce with the water running?
Both probably help. Both probably. The more friction you can get, the better. So I think if you're able to put your hands in there, that probably will help even more.
So we all have gastrointestinal challenges from time to time. How do you know that you are experiencing cyclosporiasis?
You know, it's hard. I mean, you mentioned the symptoms before, and they're very similar to what a typical GI bug would look like. The things that would set this apart, though, are going to be that it's going to last much longer. So oftentimes, you know, people, if you need treatment for it, it's going to last several weeks. And sometimes you get better and then you get sick again, you get better and you get sick again, and it can even last as long as months. So if you're seeing some type of pattern like that, definitely worth going to your doctor and making sure that they do some testing for it.
So I have 30 seconds. When should you see a doctor, and what is the treatment? 30 seconds.
So I would go to the doctor if you're starting to have symptoms of dehydration, so dizziness, feel like you're going to pass out, your heart's racing. If you're not able to keep things down by mouth, particularly liquids, definitely want to go. There's signs that you have severe dehydration. The treatment typically is an antibiotic called Bactrim if you end up needing treatment, and that's definitely something that your healthcare provider could prescribe for you.
Dr. Megan Easterday, they're lucky to have you in Cabarrus County. You're excellent as a guest and as a person who can provide what we needed to hear this morning. Megan Easterday is the medical director of Cabarrus Health Alliance. Thank you for joining us. When we come back, more challenges regarding HIV in Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHG. I'm Mike Collins. When HIV first appeared in the United States in the early 1980s, it was essentially a death sentence. The disease infected mainly gay men at the time, and no one was certain what caused it or how it was spread. There was no cure, and the likely death toll hovers between 150 and 200,000 people. Well, we now know HIV is the virus that causes AIDS, and we now have antiviral medications that can keep it at bay. We also know how the virus spreads and how to prevent that spread. There's even a drug, PrEP, that can be taken to reduce the risk of acquiring the infection. It can be almost 99% effective when taken correctly, and yet HIV continues to spread, and that is particularly true in the Black community nationwide and here in Mecklenburg County. So for the rest of this hour, we look at why this community presents more cases than the general population and at barriers to seeking care, including the stigma attached to the virus, and we examine the cost of treatment and prevention. Elvis Meneise is our race and equity reporter at WFAE News. He's here along with Johnny Wilson, health program manager of the HIV STI division at the Mecklenburg County Health Department. And Broderick Rory is practice administrator at Rosedale Health and Wellness, a nonprofit primary and specialty care provider specializing in comprehensive medical care as well as HIV AIDS treatment. Thank you all for joining us. Welcome. Elvis, I'm going to start with you with a 30,000-foot view here. How many people in Mecklenburg County do we know are currently living with HIV, and how does that compare to other areas around us?
Yeah, in terms of Mecklenburg County, right now, in 2024, there was reported 285 people living with HIV. Those are new cases. We don't have the numbers for 2025 yet because they're still trying to work those out and finalize those. In terms of how it compares, we haven't been able to look fully into that. We've mostly focused on Mecklenburg County and what that looks like in the situation here. The last proportion of that, like you mentioned, is African Americans. They account for about 60% of HIV cases here. The Latino population also accounts for about 24%, and 13% is what residents in Mecklenburg County. What we've been seeing is an increase in HIV cases from 2020 to 2024. So in 2020, in Mecklenburg County, we had 212 new HIV cases. That increased to 285 new HIV cases. And we saw a similar pattern amongst African Americans, where in 2020 we had 135 cases of new HIV cases, and that increased also to 171 in 2024, with a slight dip to 169 in 2023.
60% of new HIV cases in 2024 in Mecklenburg County were among African Americans, and that's almost twice their share of the population. Latino residents made up about 24% of new cases, and white residents only about 13%. We're going to talk to some experts in a second about this disparity, but you spoke with some folks who are living with HIV as part of a series of reports that you produced for us here at WFAE. Did the people you talked to have a theory as to why this seems to be the pattern?
Yeah, I spoke to people and they gave a whole range of different answers. For example, simple things. For example, transportation. So I spoke to one lady outside a care facilities in Huntersville, and she mentioned how, for example, not being able to have transportation to get to your care provider can be a big barrier. So she came out of a care facility pushing a stroller, basically, and she was waiting for her Uber. She mentioned how simple things like that, which may seem simple, but is really key to making sure that people are able to go to their providers and receive the support and the care they need. Also, another thing that was mentioned was stigma in the community. Sometimes people might feel ashamed or might not have enough support or may feel as if they're not comfortable enough to go to their providers and receive that care that they need, and they won't feel as if they won't be judged. So those are some of the factors. And another thing that you touched on earlier was PrEP. It seemed to me, speaking to a lot of community members, is that some people might not be taking PrEP. And that was something that continually came up in my conversations with doctors, with people which have HIV, also knowing what exactly PrEP is, which is something that we're going to touch on later on.
Broderick Rory is with us. He's the practice administrator at Rosedale Health and Wellness, which deals in many cases with HIV cases. Black people in the United States, Broderick, have been disproportionately affected by HIV since the very beginning of this infection in the early 1980s. And some say that's due, as Elvis just pointed out, to the stigma associated with it, also with higher rates of poverty, lack of access to health care, a lower awareness of the disease. Is one of those factors more important, more detrimental than the other?
All of them. All of them are equally important. I wouldn't separate any of them out. All of them are equally important because we live here in the South. We also have to include living in the Bible Belt. We also have to include religion. Let's not leave out religion, because we have our religious rules, beliefs impact how we move forward in our lives, especially from early childhood. A lot of folks don't believe in sexuality, have an honest conversation about sexuality. You talk about homosexuality in the church. You talk about how people identify gay, lesbian, bi, trans. That also impacts people's belief system, but also impacts how they navigate the world versus how they put themselves at risk. So all those things, factors are super, super important in why people are putting themselves at risk for HIV. We can't separate them out.
Johnny Wilson is with us. He's the health program director of the HIV STI division for the Mecklenburg County Health Department. Despite the availability of drugs to treat HIV, deaths for which HIV is indicated as the leading cause are highest among black people compared to people of other races and ethnicities. It hovers between 6 in 100,000 people in the black community versus 0.6 per 100,000 among whites. Is that simply because of disparities in terms of healthcare outcomes across the board, or is something else at work here, Johnny?
I think that it's a mix. So first, I do think that, like you said, like you put it earlier, that HIV looks completely different from the 80s than what it does now. Mm-hmm. So people are now being diagnosed and are not feeling sick immediately. People are being diagnosed and are able to live about their lives for a couple of years or years at a time frame, because the virus look a lot different than what it did in the 80s. So when people don't feel sick, they're not actually seeking healthcare. People are becoming positive, or are being tested for positive, or being tested for positive and not accessing meds at that time frame. So there's a lack of knowledge and education around HIV that we still need to make sure that we're instilling it in those individuals. But also the other part of that I would like to bring up as well is that it is definitely a disparity in healthcare, and people having access to healthcare.
One of the people that Elvis spoke to, Johnny, said that perhaps the reason we have a greater spread right now is because people aren't as afraid of HIV as they once were, for all the reasons you just mentioned, not the least of which is PrEP. It's available. You can take it. It may prevent you from getting it. In 99% of the cases, they say it does. So being unafraid of HIV, taking chances as a result of your lack of fear, is that healthy? Is that wise? What are you hearing from young people?
Yes. So I'm definitely not hearing that people are not afraid. I do think that we are at a different place of education. I think the problem is that it's miseducation or misinformation that is being spread and not the right information. I think that's kind of where we are right now. And I think that as people are looking at each other, thank God we have come to a place where we can say that the HIV does not have a look. It's not something that you can physically see on a person. And so that is definitely helping us with stigma. However, on the back end, like you just said as well, there isn't, people are not getting sick quicker. And so there is a disparity there, or there is it's almost like a double-edged sword there that we're seeing, where people are waiting too late to access care when they're sick. And by this time, medicine is also failing, which is why we're seeing the death rates and all the AIDS rates as well.
Broderick, you mentioned some of the stigmas, among them religion. And we've done many shows over the years on this program about this, and religion has come up many times in those conversations because it's not spoken about, or the religion itself has views about homosexuality that are not compatible with their brand of religion. And so, therefore, those people are on the outside of this. Talk to me about the role of religion, about homophobia, about just the stigma of getting this disease, whether you're straight or gay.
If we want to talk about the Black church in particular, it's a touchy subject, very touchy subject for the African-American community, but sexuality is not discussed in the church in a healthy way. Is always from a sense of damnation. When you put shame on people, shame in folks pushes them in an opposite direction. Putting negativity into their lives around their sexuality puts people at more risk for HIV. We don't want to have honest conversation in the Black church about sexuality. We need to move beyond talking about homosexuality, but let's talk about sexual health as a whole in the church, because HIV is just not a disease for homosexuals, those that identify as part of the LGBTQIA plus community. Every person that is of age that is having sex is at risk for HIV. And that's the honest conversation we need to have. We need to shift from focusing on one particular segment of the community and talk about the whole community as a whole. Because if you go to any church on any given Sunday, and if you're a pastor standing in the pulpit, there are people from all generations in your church. So that means people are having sex. So if people are having sex, we need to start having conversations about healthier sexual practice and focus on that and not talk about this homosexuality, because everybody's having sex. We need to move from segmenting it to talking about everybody and focus on healthier sexual practice and teach people how to have healthy conversation around sexuality.
And in fact, Johnny, KFF, which reports on health issues of all stripes, reports that heterosexual sex accounts for a greater proportion of HIV cases among Black people than white people. So what are we to take from that, that more straight people are getting this in the Black community?
Yes. What we are to take from that is that I think that I will agree with actually Broderick in saying that not only are we not having conversations in the church, but we're not having conversations in within our personal lives. On so I think that most individuals who are receiving or is it the receiving partner and or the more feminine partner are not comfortable with having conversations about ensuring that individuals are getting tested together, that we're wearing condoms and things like that. So there's always like some type of hierarchy situation that people are in where those conversations become uncomfortable. And we need to get to a place where those conversations are more comfortable as a feminine partner or as a person that is receiving or the insertive partner need to be able to stop and say, hey, you know, let's go get tested together. Hey, you know, let's have a conversation about sex. What is your status? Those conversations are not being had at the moment. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we're also seeing, we're seeing that across all spectrums and not just one, whether that's gay, straight, heterosexual. I think that is the prime reason why it's such a taboo conversation.
Elvis.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to add is when you look at the goals and objectives the counties has in place, is one thing they wanted to do is make sure that those are 13 years or older are tested and screened. And you might think to yourself, 13, that's a really young age. And speaking to people which are in the care field, one thing they mention is that the onus shouldn't just be on the school system to educate people about sex ed and so forth. That should also be on parents and making sure that they also play a pivotal role in making sure that children are aware of these conversations and know what's going on relating to sex ed and so forth, so that they're also equipped going forward. So I spoke to some people, one individual, an African-American, around 38. Growing up, he basically mentioned that he was in a household where his mother was a drug addict and his mother wasn't home at most of the time. So he was basically left unsupervised. So he was going out in the community and having frequent sex. And he mentioned maybe he didn't receive enough support as his other peers. Not to say that might be the reasons why that he contracted HIV, but that's something to consider. His mother is 11 years clean right now. So I think that's just something also to think about when we talk about HIV and making sure that people have the right support systems around them.
I want to come back to the age you just threw out, 13, for beginning testing in a moment. Broderick, you say that a lack of education also plays a role in all of this, the prevalence of this in the African-American community. Is that because people are unaware of HIV? They're unaware of how it spreads, or they're unaware of how they can prevent it? What lack of education specifically are you talking about?
I'm going to say lack of education, lack of awareness. Let's talk about awareness and thinking that HIV is not still relevant and prevalent in our community. That's one. Secondly, people aren't having conversations about sexual health, especially with their kids. A lot of folks are not having sexual education conversation with their kids. Sometimes they're afraid to have conversations with their children, but also they're also, how to best put this, they're leaning on the school system to educate their kids about important factors about their lives. You can teach kids the basics, the mechanics of about their bodies, reproduction, but they also need to include the emotional aspects of sex as well, and how engaging in unhealthy sexual practices can lead to not only HIV, but other STIs.
I don't know whether any of you on this panel can answer this question, but I'll ask the question anyway. Given recent political shifts and how schools are told what they can and cannot teach, and what library books can be in the library or cannot be in the library, are kids getting sufficient information in schools at the appropriate age about sexually transmitted diseases? Anybody? Okay, no, they don't know. They're not here from CMS, so I just thought I'd throw it out. Johnny, your journey into advocacy for education and prevention of this disease began when you disclosed your own HIV status as part of a science project. Science projects take place in schools, so clearly you're in school. Given the stigma and the misinformation surrounding all of this, sharing it with peers and family members and thing must have been a very brave thing to do. How did you do that?
Yes, so I actually am living with HIV myself as well, and that was the guiding factor on me doing that, was that I was diagnosed at the age of 12, 13 years old, my 13th birthday, and so when you hit the number 13, that hits hard for me as well, because I was one of those individuals that was diagnosed at that age. And so I felt like it was my right and my duty to ensure that my peers at that time frame is aware of the right information. So any chance that I got in high school, I made my projects about HIV, HIV focus, or STD, HIV, and how to protect yourself. Doing a documentary about my life and living with HIV and what that looked like was also important for me, so that they can understand that, A, yes, I can live a long, healthy life, but this can indeed happen to you.
So when you did this, I only have about 30 seconds in this segment, but when you did this science project and you told people of your diagnosis, what was the reaction? And how old were you?
I was 14, actually, because okay. It was the very next year, but after that. And the reaction, honestly, was amazing. I had been able to create a bubble at my high school, to where they kind of all got around me and things like that, and just kind of loved on me and things like that. And I think that they were more so excited to hear the news, excited to hear somebody able to kind of speak out and talk about it as well. So it wasn't any negative conversation that I got, and they also protected me as well.
I want to come back to that in a moment. We have to take a break at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the prevalence of HIV in the Black community, why that may be, and some of the stumbling blocks to getting care, receiving care, and getting information about this and how it spread. Elvis Meniesi is with us. He's our race and equity reporter at WFAE News. Broderick Rory is a practice administrator with Rosedale Health and Wellness in Huntersville. And Johnny Wilson is the health program director for the HIV STI division of the Mecklenburg County Department of Health. You were just talking about your diagnosis, Johnny, and you came out about it during a science project at the age of 14, and you were fortunate enough to get a lot, evidently, of positive response from your peer group for what must have been, before you made the announcement or made the revelation, it must have been frightening, it must have been scary, the prospect of it. Were you just lucky that that's how they reacted, or do you think more people would react that way by putting a face on this disease, that more people would be prone to delving into this more and learning more about it and having less of a stigma attached to it?
I think if given the time and space, allowing people to talk through what they're going through, with what's happening within my body, my mind, given the space to do that actually adequately and things like that, I think that people are getting more information. The more information people get, the less stigmatizing they can be towards you. But we have to allow people to the platform and the space to in order to do that. And people have to come in with an open heart and listen wholeheartedly to be able to receive that information. So I think that was why.
Elvis, both Broderick and Johnny are advocates of openly discussing this, and they've said it many times in this segment. You have spoken with a lot of individuals for that two-part series that you did of people living with HIV. Are they on the same page? Do they believe we should be more open about this and talk about this more often and publicly?
Yeah, definitely. Charlotte Black Pride hosted a forum in February, which basically opened my eyes to this, and that was focused on raising awareness and removing the stigma to it. That's when I came across the statistics about what the situation looks like in Mecklenburg County. So at that forum in February, there's about 50 people in the room, county representatives, care providers, and a lot of people which stood up and spoke about what it's like living with HIV, the challenges they face, how there's a need for more support. And yeah, with every one of my sources that had HIV, they were very confident and spoke well on the topic and just really helped to shed light on some of the challenges some people might face and what needs to change going forward. And that is having more of these conversations.
Broderick, as you well know, there are drugs that have come forward that have come along that control a person's viral load and allow them to lead very normal lives, along with PrEP, which works in most cases to prevent the transmission of this virus from one person to another. And all of that combined has neutered fear in among people, which used to grip them in the early 80s because it was a death sentence if you got it. So the upside is that the diagnosis is no longer a death sentence because of these drugs. But is there a downside?
The downside is people falling in and out of care and not staying in care. That's the downside. Or sometimes drug fatigue, which creates space for people to fall out of care. Because if you've been taking pills for a long period of time, and some people have been HIV positive for a long time, and I've encountered folks who say every time they take their pill, it reminds them of the fact that they're HIV positive, which also can create some discord within themselves and challenges around staying in care. That's the downside of it.
So in other words, when they take the pill, they're reminded that they have the disease, and that's a negative thing, and they don't want to be reminded, so they stop taking the pill?
Sometimes that happens. Sometimes that does happen, unfortunately.
Go ahead.
On the flip side of that, there are long-acting injectables now which can eliminate that distress. I myself have been positive now for 23 years. 2 years ago, I switched to the long-acting injectable. It's made a world of difference in my life versus taking a pill every day.
Explain that. What is this long-acting adjustable?
It's called Cabenuva, and I go in every 2 months, and I get an injection in both hips, both my buttocks area, and every 2 months I go in. It has freed my life versus the travel and everything else, and there's not a reminder of taking of my HIV status because I'm not taking a pill every day because I have GI issues as well. So therefore, it's eliminated a lot of the GI issues.
Johnny, Elvis met with a young woman or a woman living with HIV who told him that she heard some young people say that, oh, well, Magic Johnson got it and he's still alive, indicating that they're not concerned. And it is true, Magic Johnson did get the disease. And yes, he is still alive and evidently, by all reports, thriving. As someone living with HIV, what would you say to those young people?
What I would say is that HIV is not just a physical disease, it is a mental disease as well, right? I think that, and I've always been an advocate around mental, right? I think the effect that HIV have on your mental state is what really, really kills people, once they have given up, once the stigma has taken a hold. So when we talk about stigma, we talk about external stigma. It's another stigma called actually internalized stigma. How we value ourselves, what we think of ourselves, right? I think that also starts actually start eating away, right? Who's gonna love me? Who's gonna be in a long relationship with me because I'm positive? I think that those things really start attacking people and their mental. I think that if you're not positive at the moment, and that's the mindset that you have about Magic Johnson, and he's thriving at that moment, you don't know what Magic Johnson is going to mentally on an everyday basis. Yes, Magic Johnson is thriving, and I'm glad for him. But also, we don't know what that mental state looks like and what he goes through daily. To and you won't know until you have acquired HIV.
I'm not sure whether to ask Johnny or Broderick this question, but what is the reality? You just brought up, Johnny, an interesting fact. I mean, you may be living a normal life with taking medication on a regular basis and seeing a physician and making sure the viral load is under control, etc. And your partner may be on PrEP and being shielded from any transmission, but is there fear? Has it been difficult in relationships because of your status, either of you? I don't mean to get personal here, but is it difficult? How difficult is it for the other person?
So for me, for me, it takes a while to get there, right? It takes a while to get to the point where I'm comfortable within myself to be able to disclose that status freely and not think about or worry about what a person has to say or what their response may be, right? Because it's freeing for myself, right? It's not about you, it's about me. And I think that once people get to that point and have that approach, then they have a little bit more of an easier time with relationships and dating. But it takes people a while to get there. Initially, I think that it take because you also depending on the your partner or the person to be able to receive that information and worry about their response as well. So it takes a
Yeah.
while to actually get there.
Broderick, I know that you are an advocate of investing in care, but you're also an advocate of investing in prevention, and you say that more people need to access PrEP. How difficult or how expensive is that drug?
It's expensive, but the thing about it is there should be no reason why folks, whether they're insured or not, are not accessing PrEP, because there are programs out there now that you can get PrEP for free and get it covered for free. So cost should not be a factor for somebody not engaging in PrEP.
Johnny and Elvis want to jump in here. Johnny, I'll start with you.
Yes. So what I want to say about that is that I think that Mecklenburg County is at a very, very is actually is actually very I'm gonna say privileged inside of that, because not every county has a county commissioners that's backing them to be able to allocate amount of money for it for people that are don't have insurance or actually have under insurance that it can get PrEP for free. So everybody in the South, everybody in the world, in the United States may not have that particular access in regarding PrEP being free to them. But right in Mecklenburg County, what Bowser just said, that is correct. If you do not have insurance and or your insurance are like low insurance, or you don't really have your insurance don't cover it, there is mechanisms in place and within Mecklenburg County that you can get PrEP for free.
Elvis.
Yeah, just to add on that, I think a big part of it is also funding. So between 2020 to 2025, the counties invested over $50 million into making sure people have the right care, also testing. And I think it's also interesting to look at where some of this funding is going. For example, close to $1 million is going towards testing in the jails, for example. And I think that's very key as well, to make sure that certain populations or groups have that access to care. We talk about trying to reduce HIV, the numbers. I think that's a big part of it, is also making sure that people which are incarcerated, for example, do have access to care and also able to have the same resources as people which are outside and living in society on a day-to-day basis.
Access to healthcare in this country is disgraceful. It is difficult to get. It's expensive to get. The insurance that defrays some of those costs is expensive to maintain, unless it's coming through your employer. And many people who are gig employees don't have that privilege. That would be difficult if you had a stomach ache and you wanted to see a doctor. For some people, that there would be an impediment to getting the care they would need for that. What's it like, Broderick, if you have HIV, and you've just been diagnosed, and you know you're going to have to take these antiviral drugs for the rest of your life. If you don't have insurance, how do you do that? How do you pay for that?
Well, here in Mecklenburg County, we're funded by HRSA for a program called Ryan White, which gives them access to outpatient ambulatory care, but they get their medical visit covered and their labs covered. But also, if they don't have access to the drugs, there's also HMAP, UMAP, where they can get the drug medications for free should they qualify. And if folks are earned under 21-6, they can qualify for Medicaid when they also get their healthcare covered as well as their medication. There are options out there. So if you're HIV positive living in Mecklenburg County or even the surrounding counties where they make up the TGA, which is a targeted grant area for Ryan White services,
will cuts to Medicaid that are coming down the pike due to the big, beautiful bill, will that have an impact on people getting care for this?
Absolutely. If they're on Medicaid right then, they may have to roll back over. If they lose their Medicaid, they can roll back over to Ryan White.
See, Johnny, this sounds very complicated to me. As somebody who thinks of himself as being somewhat smart, informed, and intelligent, but if you don't follow, if you're not in that pipeline, you're living your life and that those things never occur to you, suddenly you're hit with this, you don't know where to go or what hoops you need to jump through. And there evidently are a lot of them. Are there any people that help you navigate that?
Yes. So I actually supervise a team of linkage to care specialists who works along our DIS, which is our disease intervention specialist. So we monitor everybody that is positive within Mecklenburg County. So if you had a lab test, a blood lab test in the vein that was sent to a lab, it goes directly to the state, no matter who you are, where you are, if you're getting tested within Mecklenburg County and or North Carolina. My team gets a list, and we look at that, and we look at to make sure that anybody that shows up on that list that is newly diagnosed or previously diagnosed or now out of care, we collect information and phone numbers and reach out to those individuals to make sure that they are getting the information, making sure that they are aware that they're positive, ensuring that we're connecting them to people like actually Broderick at Rosedale or any other clinics within the area to make sure that they're getting access.
When you go in for an annual physical and they do the blood draws that they do to check all your hemoglobin and albumin and all this kind of stuff that they check for in these checkups, is that one of the things that they do automatically, or do you have to request an STD or an HIV blood test?
Unfortunately, not every place do it automatically. And that's part of the plan and part of some things that we're working on as a jurisdictional level inside of our plan is to make sure that if you are a healthcare physician, that you it's best practice that you go ahead and add in an HIV STI test along with those other tests that you just mentioned. So that is a goal of ours. It's something that we're looking to do, and we're looking to do more education to providers, which is those primary care providers, not people that are currently in network, meaning the people that are currently infectious disease specialists, the people that are already coming to our meetings and having conversations with us, but people that are outside of that network, the OGBYNs, and people that are only doing primary care, making sure that they are aware of that and asking them to add that test into their regimen when they draw blood and draw labs for other things.
Well, Broderick, when COVID hit, another viral disease, when COVID hit, it seemed like in no time at all, we had these vaccines that put the virus at bay, and they worked. Otherwise, we'd still be in pandemic mode. HIV was first discovered in 1980, yet there's still no vaccine. Why?
That's a very good question. Honestly, that's a very good question, and that's a question that we've been discussing since 2020. Why isn't there a vaccine for HIV? I believe there's a vaccine out there, and I think they're holding it back from us, honestly, because being HIV is a big moneymaker for pharmaceutical companies. If you want to have an honest conversation, they're making a whole lot of money off of those who are HIV positive. So if I'm making a whole lot of money off individuals in the country that are HIV positive, why would I want to end it? That's just my thought.
Some people do not see themselves as being at risk, Johnny. Are they right?
No. If they are having any type of sex, whether that's oral, whether that's vaginal, whether that's anal, you are at risk. Whether you're married and having sex, guess what? You are at risk. You don't know what your partner is doing. You're not with them 24 hours a day. You don't live in their skin. That's why it is important for people to take responsible for their own health, getting on PrEP, making sure that they're getting tested every 6 months, making sure that they're doing, finding it in their routine and put it inside of their self-care regimen.
Johnny Wilson is the Health Program Director for the HIV-STI Division for the Mecklenburg County Health Department. He joined us along with Broderick Rory, Practice Administrator at Rosedale Health and Wellness. He's also helped to administer, I believe, the Ryan White program and the Dudley Project. And Elvis Menese is our Race and Equity Reporter here at WFAE. Thank you all for the program.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.